found that that place had been cleared of snipers. He was in there deploying all the correct movements, keeping under cover and so on, approaching a village which has snipers, and he met a Canadian, an English soldier. And John said, "Has this place been cleared of snipers?" He said, "I hope so, it's our divisional headquarters." So John told the man to go on back, and he went to the local store and bought a bottle of cognac and proceeded to quaff that off. And that's another story. The next, later that night, we moved up to the front, marched all night. We had been sent then to the Nova Scotia. The North Nova Scotia Regiment took an awful beating in, on D-Day landing, one of the worst of any of the Canadian regiments.
Mm-hmm.
And so John and I and Ken Crabtree and the 35 men we had with us were all sent up to there. An interesting point I'll bring up, though, when we were marching in off the shore the night before, or that evening, we met civilians who were around the beach. And we had been warned, do not speak to any local people, because if they were sympathetic towards the Allies, they would have been moved back. So the people on the coast were suspected supporters of the German occupation force. And I heard one woman call her son, Adolf. That to me indicated that that was true, that they were supporters of the German occupation.
Hmm.
Well, again, back to that night, we marched up and took our position in behind the Nova Scotias. But there was such heavy shelling with mortar bombs that the CEO of the Nova Scotia sent word back that we were to stay where we were for the time. And we spent, I think, another night there, and then we moved up to the North Novies. But going into the ward of the North Novies, there was a German half-track wrecked on the side of the road, and a German soldier lying on it. And he was lying on his back with his upper part of his torso hanging back over towards the ground, and his face as black. And I couldn't help think what an awful sight for green recruits coming into action to see this. You know, it's too bad somebody hadn't got rid of the body. Well, we got there, and as soon as we got there, of course, the mortar attack. And everybody, of course, dies for shelter into the weapon pits. And that was our reception there. Mm-hmm. Use what we call the moaning minis. It's a mortar bomb with a screaming device on it. And you can hear it coming. And whether it's anywhere near you or not, of course, you feel it's all zeroing in on you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very demoralizing weapon. And you can hear them coming. Of course, everybody dives. And of course, the thing could be 100 yards away, you know, but you felt for sure it was coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed there. I got there in, say, June the 8th, probably, two or three days after after D-Day. And I stayed with North Novas for the full month. And we were bombed. And we sent out patrols, just keeping to see what was going on.
Your whole company stayed with them?
This group of 35, which is really a platoon.
I see.
We went in. We didn't go in as a unit. We went in to reinforce different units. I was in one, I was a platoon commander of one platoon. John had another platoon in another company. But we were in the general area there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had patrols go out. I was sent out on one patrol with two soldiers. We were to go in behind the enemy lines and stay there the whole day, move in one night, stay the whole day and listen and make notes what was going on back there, and then come back the following night and they'd be waiting. You know. So we left just at dark and across. At this point in Normandy, it's all agriculture and it's flat land, wheat fields and open unplowed land and so forth. And we went on, and you only have about 4 hours of darkness there. And we went on and on, and we got this open field. And one of the men said to me, "Shall we make a dash for it?" And I said, "No, let's take it easy and crawl across, because we'd be sitting ducks if someone in that wheat field was watching for us." We got to the other side, and just as we were crossing, just reaching the wheat field, I saw somebody stand up in front of me and could hear voices. Couldn't make out what it was, but heard voices. Then he stepped down again. And I assumed there was a weapon slit there, and we'd hit right into a German center, although there wasn't supposed to be anybody there from previous patrols.
Mm-hmm.
So I signaled to the fellow just to freeze, which we did, and waited. I looked back for the other fellow was with us. Couldn't see him, didn't know what happened to him. So I realized we're to go around now, we were going to waste a lot of time. We wouldn't make it in time for daylight. So I signaled to this chap in front of me that we're going to back across this field into the grain of where we'd come from and just see how things looked then. Went back and we assessed the situation, realized that the distance we had still to go with the weapons occupied in front, the weapon pits occupied in front of us, the chance of us getting into position before dawn in the short time we'd left would not be possible. So we came back, never did find the other chap. So we got back into our lines all right, and I left a message with the units who were looking after the lines at the front, the platoon, our own platoons that were out there, that there would be a man coming in. Never came in. And the following night he came back. He told the story that as he was crossing this field, he had a Sten gun with him and the ammunition pouches, and he'd lost one of the magazines. Mm-hmm. So he went back looking for it. So then he looked for us. He couldn't find us. But he said he came to the same spot we were. He saw these people and heard voices. So he did the same thing. He turned back. But he didn't know where we had gone. And so he stayed over all that next day mm-hmm. in that wheat field. And then he came back and joined us. Well, the next day, the Nova Scotia sent in a fighting patrol to clean out and see what was in those weapons. And there was nobody in them at all. So the next night, sent out another patrol to see if they can get in behind the lines. And again, they were occupied. So what they apparently were doing were moving them around. Sometimes they'd occupy here, sometimes over here. Another time, after a very, very heavy bombing of Caen, we were north of Caen, but it wasn't that far away, you know, in miles. We could see an air raid or something. We would see the fires and so on from Caen. And one day in the afternoon, a black limousine came up from Caen with white flags flying. And it was supposedly the mayor of Caen. If not, it was certainly his alderman, the council. Came up asking us to stop the shelling of Caen, give them a chance to bury their dead. So we passed them through. They had to go. We're taken to the brigade. And I never did find out what it was, but never stopped bombing Caen, of course, because Germany was using it as one of their headquarters. So it couldn't be declared an open city at all. And so that was another interesting, I thought, story.
Yeah. How are the men taking battle at this point?
It seemed to be fine.
Yeah.
You have company. This is the main thing.
Yeah.
You're not alone
right.
until you go on patrol, and then all of a sudden you feel you're very much alone.
Mm-hmm.
And there are only three of us out there, and you get a very lonely feeling when in those circumstances. But the rest of it, you're surrounded with people. And it's strange, Cameron, I'm not going to get hurt. Somebody else might get hit. But you get that feeling that you're immune to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of keeps you going. Well, after, on July the 1st of 1944, I was transferred back to the Canadian Scottish and joined them at the city of Rots, R-O-T-S. And I was with them from July the 1st until we moved forward and attacked Coucy, which was just north of Caen, in preparation for moving into the city of Caen.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that on the 8th of July. And then I was wounded on that day at 6 o'clock in the evening. So that was the end of my experiences in France. But I was, where we were in Rots, there was an elderly gentleman and his daughter. I guess she'd be in her 40s probably, and he in his 70s. And they had a large home in this little village, and we were actually staying around on the property. So she invited me one night to come in for an evening meal. Well, I went in with them and had a chat with them. They spoke perfect English. During World War I, he had been an interpreter for the British Army. But however, he was still there, and this is why we were suspicious of the two of them, because if he had been pro-English, he certainly wouldn't have been there. The Germans would have moved him out. She had been traveling a lot. She'd been to Vancouver, and she'd been down the States. She'd been to Hollywood, she told me. And so I found it very interesting with the two of them. But you have to be awfully careful what you're saying, because always the big question mark, why did the Germans leave them here, particularly when they could speak English? I never knew what happened to them. She gave me her card. They had a home in Paris, she said. And she said, if ever you're back, you look me up.
Yeah.
Well, of course.
You didn't
never did, of course.
You didn't notice if they were trying to maybe sneak some...
No. It was a very informative evening. But she talked most of the time about her traveling.
Oh.
And we had this, I remember having a sour flavored French bread loaf and berries and cream. I can remember that, wow.
Mm-hmm.
But then my experience from then on was just a matter of this attack. And when we were attacking on the... All right, I'll backtrack a bit. We were to move in on Kusi. It's a little village which was north of Khan. That was our objective, to take this town, little village. And we moved to another estate to get ready for moving off in the morning of the 8th of July. So on the 7th, in the evening, we moved into this area. We bedded down for the night. And during that night was a massive assault on Khan by British and American bombers. I've recorded as a 500 plane raid in my diary, but others have told me it was a 1,000 plane raid. And the whole sky was red with it. And in the silhouette in the red, you could see the planes, you could see parachutists coming down. It was a, you know, you can imagine the explosions that 1,000 or even 500 planes could drop on a town. And the next day, we moved off. And I remember going down through this field, there was growth around us, and seeing a Canadian soldier dead there. So I took my platoon around, just so they wouldn't see it. It's not very encouraging sight when you're moving into action. Men, no problem, they would come, they followed. They were in company with lots of people. Even I led them through. I had my platoon sergeant, there was a platoon over there, and there was a platoon over here. We had company, and it didn't seem that we were alone, that we were okay. And then we had to hold up and wait while other units moved into position, and then we took an awful shellacking from these mortar bombs, and we quickly dug in, and this time one of the stretcher bearers came to me. He had really broken down. He was the one attached to us to go through with us, and he wept and wept. So I sent him back because he would be no use to us. But that's the only instance I know of a soldier cracking up in the short time that I was in action.
Really?
And then we moved off, and this would be after 4 o'clock on July the 8th. And my platoon had a hedge as an objective where there was supposed to have been an 88 millimeter weapon. We were to take that out. As we were approaching this area, all strung out in a great area moving across, on my right was a cross. Oh, it must have been 20, 30 feet high with a figure of Christ on it. And amidst all the shelling and the smoke, the dust, the noise, it seemed so out of place. And I'll come back to that later, but I mention this now. And then we moved in, and then this explosion, and the soldiers by the Germans had pulled out of that particular area where we were. Although they were around and we were shooting, firing as we went through, I was wounded, knocked down, rifle blown out of my hands, and lay there and couldn't move. I was paralyzed down the legs. And with me was a fellow Lamb, and he also had been hurt. And he was in my platoon, and I gave myself a shot of morphine, which we carried with us for this. And I wasn't a smoker, I'd quit smoking, but he threw his cigarettes over to me. And I'll tell you, that was the finest thing that ever happened to me. I never realized before how the fact that you can just, having a cigarette in your mouth and drawing on the cigarette and the smoke seemed to, plus the morphine, I guess,
mm-hmm.
seemed to quiet me down. And then we heard a tank. And I thought, oh good, our tanks are here. I looked up and there was a German tank coming right down on top of us. And I couldn't, I dragged myself into the hedge a little farther. But Lamb, he was over about 20 feet from me. And we were talking back and forth, and he threw his cigarettes to me, and he couldn't move, and the tank ran over his foot. And then one of our men with a Piat gun, with an anti-tank gun, he hit the tank and stopped it. And then it was destroyed by an anti-tank gun. But that's how close I came to being crushed, and he actually ran over. His foot was crushed under the tank. Well, then I was taken away that night into, we had jeeps rigged up as ambulance carriers. The driver would be here in his seat, and there would be a stretcher beside him, and a rack above him that took two more stretchers. And my brother was there at the time. He was in the same company I was, sergeant. And they got me onto the Jeep ambulance, and I went back to advanced dressing station and to a hospital, and I was operated on that night. And then eventually I was, I guess it would be the next day, I don't know, I don't recall time on this, I was kind of hazy about it, flown over to a hospital in England on the Dakota, you know, the DC-3, the old workhorse. I always say that two vehicles won the war. One was the Jeep and the other was the Dakota plane. And it was fitted up with stretchers, too. It was so tight with stretchers along the center aisle, on racks. We were just shoved in on racks. I couldn't turn over. My shoulder was so close to the stretcher above me.
Mm.
And then I went to a hospital in central England. And from there, I was carted down to Horsham. Here I am back in Horsham again, which was so much a part of my existence in England.
Mm-hmm.
And the hospital in Horsham, and that's where I went through further operations. And eventually, I don't think I've mentioned this to you on the tape about the shortage of infantry officers,
mm-hmm.
but I was out of hospital after a month, and I went back to Aldershot, and I was getting ready to go back into France. I still had dressings on my wounds, but we were so short of infantry officers that that didn't matter. We were sent back in, dressings and all.
Mm.
Then word came through my brother had been killed, and I was taken off that draft to give him a chance to myself to get settled. In the meantime, a group had been organized in Stenning in Sussex to train service corps and ordnance officers to become infantry officers, and they wanted battle experienced officers to train them, so I went down and worked with them there, and I stayed there for quite a few weeks. My wounds acted up and I was sent back to hospital and then eventually sent back to Canada.
Mm-hmm. So that ended it all?
That was it for me. You know,
uh-huh.
I was in Petawawa. I was back in Shaughnessy Hospital for a month and then I was sent to Petawawa, and I was an intelligence officer at a training center there. And then I was discharged in June, and that was it in 45.
I guess that's it. One last question. Any outstanding incidents in the whole campaign that you were there in France?
I don't think so, other than what I've said. So that was only in from June the 7th until July the 8th, so what am I, a month and one day before I'm out of there?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose after I leave here and go home, I'll think of things I might have said, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was pretty well it.
Okay, well, thanks for your time.
It was a frightening experience at
uh-huh.
times. There was humor, but really, you, for instance, you'd be sitting down in your weapon pit, writing a letter, and then these moaning minis would start, you know, and you'd wonder if this was the one. It would hit around close enough that the dirt from the side of your weapon pit would vibrate and fall down on the letter you were writing, this type of thing. Then you'd hear it, someone over there 100 yards got hit away, you know. I had a very resourceful platoon sergeant, and it was a farming country, so he'd come in with a chicken all plucked and cooked, and we'd have chicken, you know, and that sort of thing. It kept our army rations going. Army rations, by the way, were very good. They had various letters and names. They came in by the case, and you could draw, there are different letters. There were about five different types you would get, so you had a bit of variety, but it included meat pies and sausages. It would have, you'd have liver and bacon, I suppose, I don't know. But there'd be puddings always. There'd be treacle puddings and date puddings, and you'd heat them up. Anything that had to be heated up, you'd heat up in your mess tent over a little gas burner, a little alcohol burner.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were quite good. Until you moved forward, then you had dry food with you to tide you over until you get established once more.
Mm-hmm.
But the organization behind it must have been fantastic to supply us with that type of food. And
was it tinned?
Yes, it come in cans. And you could eat it just cold out of the can. It was all cooked. Or you could heat it up. If it was stew, for instance, it would be cooked stew. You could eat it cold or hot.
Mm-hmm.
The puddings, for instance, I always remember these treacle puddings, the date puddings. They're really tasty.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be out there, right, and being bombed, and you'd be eating beautiful date pudding and maybe a canned stew, which you'd heat it up. Because you were pretty well on your own. when you're under fire, you don't move into a central area and all have your meals. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So these little compact dinners were the answer.
Hmm.
So you have to give credit where credit's due.
Yeah.
Somebody did a fantastic organizational job to get all that done for us.
Any complaints?
No.
About how things
I was
run.
Lucky. I was
yeah.
lucky. My oldest brother joined the battalion after all the time he put in, which is the same length of time I did, in training. He came back with me for officer training. Went overseas later than I did. He was at in Ontario. Didn't get overseas as quickly as I did that time. By the time he joined the Scottish, it was the 14th of August, and he was wounded on the 15th and sent home. So he, after all that training, he had one day in action. My brother, who didn't come back, the sergeant, he was in my company, and he was killed at Falaise Gap. And then my youngest brother, the fourth one, he came in, joined the unit when they were in Holland, and he was in there to the end of the war. And he got nicked on the chest with a bullet or a bit of shrapnel, but other than that, he actually survived longer than in action than the rest of us did.
Hmm.
So that's really all I can say that I think would be of interest to you.
Yeah, no, that was great. Thanks a lot for your time.
Cameron, delighted to do it.
Okay.